Welcome to the Design Systems Podcast. We're all about the places where design and development overlap. We talk with the industry experts about trends in design, development, and take a look at new ways to build digital experiences, typically over a beer or two. As always, this podcast is brought to you by Knapsack. Check us out at knapsack.cloud or at knapsackcloud. If you want to get in touch with the show, ask some questions, or generally tell us what you think, go ahead and tweet us at the DS Pod. We'd love to hear from you. We are still under lockdown for this episode, and so there may be some children screaming in the background, dogs barking, lawnmowers going. It always seems like when we try to do these things, the worst possible non-studio environment happens. But what I'm really excited about is having Adam Argyle on the podcast today. Welcome, Adam. It's great to have you.
Yo, thanks. Yeah, I'm stoked.
So Adam and I actually met at Seattle Interactive Conference last year in October, I believe it was. And we were at one of those, ridiculous, like speaker kind of engagement party things. And it was a really good time because I ran into Adam, and over the course of about an hour and a half and a few beers, we ended up just riffing on design systems the entire time. And I found out that he actually works at Google and Chrome CSS developer relations. He also maintains this really awesome tool called VizBug. And we just had a great convo, and I've been wanting to get this on the books for a while now, and I'm really excited we get to take this amazing conversation we had and rehash it in this format.
It was really memorable. I had a blast. I'm excited to rehash it too. I'm hoping we can cover all the cool things we hit, because we had like a crowd getting around us like, what are these two people like getting so worked up about? And it was really fun.
Yeah, no, it was a really good time. And I think that it made what I was expecting to not be my favorite event of the conference into my favorite event of the conference. So,
yeah,
always great to make new friends over beers and chatting about things you're passionate about.
I didn't want to go home.
Well, so starting off, tell us a little bit about what CSS developer advocacy means at Google.
Yeah, it's a lot of creating guidance, you know, showing how things are done, helping people who currently have problems. So I try to keep my ear to the ground in terms of like general sentiment with CSS and things that are going on. I try to pass those to the CSS working group and to the Chromium engineers and make sure things are on a priority list. But yeah, there's also things like creating games or little fun little videos that help showcase what things do. And so I made one about Flex Gap recently. I was really happy with the nice Flex Gap internationalization video, which is just like, yeah, try and doing this with margin. It'd just be so many media queries. It'd be a bummer. So yeah, just making this stuff digestible, having a representative that listens to the community and tries to push things back. It's really fun.
Cool. And then you also recently started your own video podcast with Yuna, right?
Yeah, the CSS podcast. We kind of wanted to take similar strategies that the base CS podcast and other sort of computer science related podcasts, but do that for CSS. So really dig into the computer science aspects of CSS, but make them digestible and something that you can listen to in 10 minutes and walk away with more knowledge. It's been really fun.
Yeah, you want to give a plug for where people can listen in?
Yeah, that's pod.link/the CSS podcast. You can find us on, Google Podcasts, Spotify, all the regular ones. We're at episode 8 or 9 right now. So we just released ones on color and ones on logical properties, and grid and flex are coming out soon. And man, they are packed with energy somehow. That's some pretty bland, like the main axis and the cross axis. Like that could be some really boring shit. And I think we turn it into something kind of fun. So...
No, and that's the hard part, right? When you have a podcast that is super technical, that is really focused on code, like how do you show code when you're just using your voice?
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of why I like the Flexbox one so much is there's a main axis and a cross axis, and you probably don't have those memorized. Like, why would you? What kind of robot are you? After I give this example where I'm like, okay, how about your Zorro? You're the Flexbox layout engine, and you're laying out something in Latin. So it's left to right. People are going to hand write left to right. And then the blocks, like the contents, stack on top of each other from top to bottom, right? A new paragraph goes under the previous one. So the main axis is the way that you slice, like Zorro, and you're going to slice from left to right across the middle, shing, and that's your inline axis. Then there's also the block axis, which is like you have a battle axe, and that goes from top to bottom. So inline is like Zorro swiping left to right, and block is like you have a battle axe. and I don't know, fantasy.
No, I have a new idea for like a Twitter profile pic for you. Is you in a Zorro mask with a battle axe in your hands?
Or I'd be dual wielding. It's like, okay, which way do you need me to slice? I'm Flexbox. I'm easy.
Yeah, now you're talking my language. The D&D DM is going to come out here soon.
Yep, it definitely felt like that. I liked it.
So, hey, man, talk to me about design systems a little bit. I think that that's kind of where our conversation really started was, you know, you came up to me wearing a shirt that said CSS in like wonderful 80s, fabulous, like gradient, sort of like splatter paint style. And I think I was like, yo, like your shirt. And then we kind of went off to the races on design systems, you know, and honestly, like one of the things that sticks out to me is you were a little bit critical of some of the problems that are trying to be solved inside of the design systems world and how, you know, kind of similar to some of the other topics that we've covered that you kind of feel like, hey, are we just kicking the can down the road on fragmentation? So explain that to me a little bit.
Yeah, I think that is why we got so heated is you were eloquently defending design systems. And I was somewhere in the fence, like where I criticize them, but I want them to work, you know? And so I think one of the, like, here's an opinion I have that's a spicy opinion, which is I don't necessarily think a design system is what designers want. And I mean that like the freedom that they have right now, the expression that they have right now is unbounded, that it's unfettered. And that's kind of the problem, right? We're like, well, we need you to be in a design system that is constrained, just like reality. And so I kind of like them both. I think they both need to coexist. And a lot of design system mentalities think that the old way is going to die. And I attribute this to a metaphor, which is, do you know what a capsule wardrobe is?
No, I don't.
It's a wardrobe that an individual makes that any item can go with any other item. So they're usually monochromatic. They're very much like a design system for your clothes. Your shoes will always go with that shirt and always go with any pants you grab. There's no way to screw up your wardrobe with a capsule wardrobe. So here's my analogy here is while that sounds really nice and it's really got a good presence on Pinterest, like there's tons of capsule wardrobes, in practice, I think what happens is if you were a company that made a capsule wardrobe for all your designers, the first thing designers are going to do is rip sleeves off, go grab a knife and cut some cool slices into it. And they're going to start finding the edges and the fringe of where they can go express as just a thing that's what they do. Like, it's almost like they're breaking out of the box or starting outside the box and working inwards has always been their thing. Mm-hmm. So, that's one spicy opinion is that I'm not sure we actually want the thing that we're all hacking towards. I think it's good for us, but it's not a panacea.
No, and I agree with the not being a panacea thing. I think that that's why we have off ramps, right? Like we create this sense of, you know, a really good design system runs maybe 80% of the experiences on a site. Definitely not 100 because you always want those touches. But I think that like to your point of do designers actually want it? I think that what a lot of pressure in the industry has created on design teams and product teams generally is like this pressure to ship, right?
Yeah.
Hey, go ship 500 features this year. You know, this demand for like, let's go meet our users everywhere and meet them in a really consistent way. Like that has a lot of business value.
Such a good goal.
Yeah. And all of these businesses want this, right? They want to be able to say like, you know, if it's on Alexa, if it's on Google Home, if it's on my iPhone, if it's on my Android device, if it's on my refrigerator, I can get access to the things I need as a consumer of this company's product. And so with this proliferation, like these screens, and Brad Frost talks about this all the time, right? Like we're literally drowning in this sea of technology here. And the pressure on these digital product teams is intense. And so I think what happens as a result of that pressure, you get a lot of digital product teams that end up being production houses. Like they literally sit as designers. And instead of actually doing that like innovative, creative, you know, unbounded, unfettered work you were talking about, they're actually super bounded of like, hey, you go make tables. You go make buttons. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes like kind of what their job is in these organizations is to go in and attack these very specific design problems. And the constraints don't become technical. They become human.
Mm. And that's a really good observation, too. So when I was on Google Cloud as a UX engineer on the design system team, the design system team was split into three parts. And it was huge. I think there were 60 of us or so. So just let that sink in. How much was Google investing in just the maintenance and creation of a design system? And the three teams were layout. Oh, okay. It was a site shell. So it was like overall cohesion. So there was a team that was building the macro elements of the site, as well as the layouts. They were sort of like macro. Oh, no, it was like macro, layouts, and then components. And they were just busy all day keeping their sticker sheets up to date with production. And then production would be broken, and then you'd have it better sticker sheets than production. And it was very, very hard to manage. And all these teams, you're right, they weren't expressing anymore. And they all felt very squelched as a designer. The design system sticker sheet became a project of shackles that you would like deliver to other people. It's like, this is all you can use. Right. Isn't that what you want as a designer? And you're like, well, I don't know. Maybe I see the value here, though. And consistency is, I think, totally worth all this effort. Yeah, and I'm glad you touched on multiple screens. That's, I think, one of Knapsack's best features here is decentralization and the ability to sort of distribute values across the consumers. I think that's really smart. So,
cool. Thank you. You know, looking at that team and thinking about, you know, 60 people in design and engineering all working furiously to try to create this design system that was able to manage this, you know, multifaceted monstrosity that is Google. You know, and you also think about things like Material, and you think about a lot of the other work that Google has contributed to the design system space. Like, the investment there has to be gigantic. I can't even imagine how many millions of dollars go into projects like that. And not only that, the ripple effect of that, of like, okay, so all these millions of dollars go get spent on something like Material. And then thousands of people then consume that design system to use in their own, you know, digital projects. That's a pretty unbelievable amount of human effort that is going into the creation of something that allows you to try to scale. And I think that just kind of stresses the importance of it.
Yeah, Material is a gorgeous success story. And then it's funny, you go talk to the teams that work on it, and on the inside, you know, like getting behind the curtains and meeting the band, and they're like, are you kidding? There's bugs all over it. You know, and from the outside, you're like, this is so polished and perfect. Oh. And it's, I like those perspectives too, because knowing both is really important. But yeah, look at that investment. And it's so good. It's very healthy.
No, it's crazy important to understand like what's behind the curtain, right? Because we're all experimenting right now in this space. Like, there is no set of standards or rules. Like, I was actually talking to Tori Davis, who works at GitLab, yesterday. And what Tori was saying is, like, they've taken a very frameworky approach to their design system. And it's really interesting, where they're like, we don't want prototyping. We don't want sandboxes. We want to be able to deliver the slimmest possible payload to our consumers of our design system. And that's things like they don't even allow you to attach image assets into your component examples, right? So it is literally like raw containers that they're shipping all over the place. And I mean, it's a little more than that. But,
yeah,
you know, that's a take that is very different than what you hear most of the time, which is like, give me this really rich component playground a la, you know, Storybook or even Knapsack of how do I go and like touch the thing I coded?
Yep. And that was one of the things the UX engineers on the design team system at Google Cloud spent a lot of time doing, was making sure that the docs weren't just text. Here's just kind of funny about design systems at Google. The most effective UI pattern to actually teach and have something stick is the do and don't. It's the picture of what to do and the picture of what not to do. The rest of it is almost like blurry to people. They just want to know how not to screw it up. Anyway, it's really funny, but we did. We spent a lot of time making levers and sliders that people could go tweak and tweeze and pull and see the fringe of the offering of the components. And that was a moving target. Right, we had a main trunk that was constantly being updated on Google Cloud. We had the design system being built in sticker sheets, and we had prototypes trying to consume and unify these things into something that cohesively brought both teams together into a single source of truth, which I hate that word.
Right.
Anyway, yeah.
Single source of truth is a funny thing, right? Like, that's a spicy take as well, right? Is this idea of like, maybe there actually isn't one. Maybe there's a single source of truth for a moment in time for a particular person or group of people. But it's all about trying to get that collaboration to be a much tighter loop. Yeah. I think that's probably a better way to put it. I mean, single source of truth is nice because it's a great soundbite, right? But like,
oh yeah,
the reality is that you're going to have that source of truth advance in different places at different times. And so how do you sync up that advancement? How do you have this workspace where people can really collaborate on what that single source of truth is, even if it advances differently across different disciplines or different parts of the team.
Yep. And that was like, while I was on the design system team there, I started thinking about a couple problems that we've alluded to here real quick, which is, what if my design system has a child design system? Mm-hmm. What if it's forked? And what if it's forked multiple times? How do I keep other teams in sync with the main fork of the design system? I don't have answers for that, but it sort of relates to this other concept of there's multiple viewports of where your design system shows up. And right, if it's on an Android device, you can't send certain colors and values there. You have to adjust it. So like if you're sending it to iOS, you can't send an RGB color in CSS's RGB. You got to send the proper channel values to the proper function. And so there's a system here where the truth is only true in this spec, but then there's a reality as it lives on each native platform, because you want to lean into the consistencies of the platform as they converge with your own design system's consistency. So maybe that's even one of the issues that I've never really articulated as well as I hope to right now, which is you're building something for something that already has a design system. When you deliver on iOS, people are already adjusted to a design system of the platform, and now you're a layer in addition. You're already composing yourself with another one. And sometimes design systems like to grab so much control. They don't want that merger. So I always like to lean into it. So to me, like your design system might be defined in a single place, but you're only representing it on the web and representing it on Android and representing it on iOS. I expect them to be different. So how do I align these as a team? Anyway, this is a hard problem to solve. It looks like Knapsack has some like built-in features here that I think can help. I saw in the variants. I don't know. Can Knapsack help me with this issue?
Yeah, no, we don't talk a lot about Knapsack on this podcast. So I'm excited to dive into it a little bit. So one of the ideas that you have, right, are these layers of design systems. And so in the layer cake of your design system stack, right, you have this sort of baseline piece, which is like, what is the thing that is most portable? And also like, for lack of a more defined term, like the most true, the most number of times, right? Mm. And those are your token values. And yeah, through mix-ins and through like some of the stuff that we did with Theo and Style Dictionary, you know, you have all these abilities with these baseline elements to kind of make them ultra portable, right? And then there's this next level that is like, okay, so maybe I just want to cover everything for the web. And so I want HTML and CSS because that's what web browsers know how to interpret. I wish that there was a more clear analog for that in native app land. And this is actually a friction point that I'll get to in a second. So you have your basic design tokens. You then have like basic HTML and CSS. And that gets you a long part of the way, right? Because you can always at least copy and paste HTML and CSS because that browser mm-hmm. is going to understand what that is. And then what lots of people do is they subdivide by templating language. So you have, you know, your server-side templating languages, things like PHP. You have your JavaScript client-side languages like, you know, Angular, React, Vue, etc. And so, you know, these tend to be these sub-design systems that are then an implementation point across there. But that is all really challenging to maintain, right? Like that is kicking the can down the road fragmentation-wide. So you're basically saying like, hey, you know, I have these main design systems that control my brand. And then I also have all of these different subsystems that are associated with technology. And then you take that one more level down and you say, now I have all these different subsystems that are associated with the actual like implementation of that brand or that product. I believe that's four levels of complexity just right there. And so what's really great about something like Knapsack is that you take all that and you just collapse it down and you say like, okay, there is an architecture that allows you to make it so that every single one of those steps is additive. And through really nice revision control and release management, you can make all that complexity more or less opaque to a user. All that complexity is managed in the background and it's managed with Git. And so you have really strong revision management across all of your different pieces of your system. You're able to define those subsystems, but you don't have to go about managing them. All of that happens in an API layer that is behind the scenes. And so the UI that is presented is the UI that is relevant to the context of that particular user trying to accomplish that one task. And this gets into some stuff with Ethan Marcotte as well, where he talks about the hyper object, right? And how design systems are this hyper object where these huge ripple effects exist from our design system. And you can only really know like the slice of that thing that you can see. We try really hard with Knapsack to present that slice, but also try to have the ability to house a lot of those ripples inside of it.
Yeah. I think you recapped that really nice. And it kind of makes me want to reach for something like, what's it called? A visual regression testing or something like that integrated here. But you mentioned like a keyword to me about design systems, which is Git. And the more and more I've been with design systems and seen them, the more and more I think they need to be more like Git. So I have a whole deck, and I'm probably giving away my $1 million idea right now, but maybe it's not $1 million idea, but it's a GitHub very like interface for design systems, where the repo is a design system and you can see all the forks, you can see the branches, shit merges back in the same way, and then you can distribute it that way too.
That's so funny.
But it would have to have additional powers that need to be able to demonstrate how this works across the different consuming platforms. So like, what's it look like on Android? So this would be more visual than it is code exploratory. You'd have screen exploration or renderings or emulations being shown instead, that are like attempted real renderings of your current thing. Anyway, so yeah, I think Git and design systems need to be more alike, even though they're slowly becoming like an API and a server and distributable. Anyway, so my ears perked up. I was like, yes.
No, it's really super funny that you mention it that way. That's literally how I describe us in our elevator pitch most of the time is I say, you know, we're looking to try to be the GitHub for experiences. So, you know, if you want to have that experience layer that exists, you know, there's APIs all over the place for things that we don't see, right? Like there's mm-hmm. APIs for infrastructure management, there's APIs for content, there's APIs for all of these different things that are a part of our tech stacks, but there's not really an API for experiences. And so while it is an experiences API, the intent of how you model that interaction is through something like a GitHub-like interface to your design system. And yeah, in the back end, like, you know, Git back databases are kind of like a new hotness anyway, right? Like everybody just wants to store JSON files in Git because it handles all that messy branching, merging, you know, the ability to do all of this really interesting innovation in a silo and then bring that back into the main part of the actual like thing you care about. And so that sort of like distributed nature of Git is incredibly powerful in when you're talking about something like a design system where you are going to have dozens of collaborators, at least four different subsystems most of the time, and potentially hundreds, if not thousands of products that the thing is powering. And then you can imagine like there's a network effect here too, right? So if you're, you know, Google building stuff in Material inside of a system that allows lots of other people to contribute and manage that contribution in some controlled way, that advances Material. But then you could also have like IBM Carbon right alongside it, right? And people could basically say, like, I want to pick the parts of each of these design systems that I want to use. And that creates this way of basically curating an experience for your consumer that is way more powerful than what is out there today, where there's all these different upstream pipelines that are essentially locked inside of individual companies.
I love this idea of instead of designers sitting down and throwing up a comp on the screen, a PR gets made in this system. And the PR runs continuous integration and continuous delivery and visual regression testing and shows the results and the ripple effects. You're right. There's a network effect here that if this becomes a thing, you can now track all your children and all your forks and they can all get an update that says they're behind and they can pull from master. I mean, they get all of the same benefits, but I really want designers to make that PR because the offering of a PR is a beautiful thing. And if you can back it with CI/CD and you have designers confidently suggesting changes to your design system, holy shit, that's amazing. They're not just stabbing at their synthetic sticker sheets. Sorry, designers. That work in there is valuable and I like it too. It's very satisfying, but it is super synthetic and it's brittle and you know it and it's okay. Anyway, but imagine that you could present a PR, you could submit a change to your design system that was validated by computers and then humans went in and reviewed all the rendered comps and said, yeah, this change looks awesome. This is exactly what we want, except in merge, you know, and boom, your work goes in, the version bumps on the design system. All the child design systems get invalidated. They're all out of date. They all need to sync and you can see who's out. You could be like, nah, dude, the IT team, they haven't pulled from master in a month, dude. That's why their shit looks weird is they're behind on It'd be so magical.
It opens the door for so many things like audit tools, right? So like if you have the ability to know where people are pulling from your design system, you have the ability to know, like you said, who's up to date and who isn't. But you also have the ability to know who's using what components where. And so that traceability of components is actually really cool. And you can know what variables they're passing to them. And so you can basically say like, hey, I understand that like this version of a button is used on, you know, 80% of my consuming experiences. And so like that version of a button is really, really important. But this other thing, like this other variable feature inside of a button has almost never changed from default. So maybe that's not that important. And it helps kind of guide like where you spend time in UX, right? So how do I know, like, this is a big problem for UX and design folks, like kind of all over the place, right? Is how do I know what to focus on next? How do I know what my next big like thing is to go tackle? And so, you know, people do big experience audits, they do lots of research, they do all these other sorts of things, but it's a really hard to get data about how your actual consumer experiences are being driven. Mm. So this provides that audit tool for that. But back to your prior point, you know, the power of the pull request, right? So you go tell a designer, like, go make a pull request. And for a lot of designers, they're like, what's a pull request? You know, not all of them. There's tons of like very technical designers that are out there. But like what we found was the way to make that possible was to abstract it. Don't call it a pull request. Say, hey, I'm proposing a change.
Yeah.
And make all that work happen in the background. And so the key thing for a workflow for managing a design system is just what Git does. It's that I can propose a change, I can talk about a change, and I can accept or reject that change. And that is incredibly powerful. And we figured out the power of that on the developer code side of things, you know, 8-9 years ago. And we're just starting to bring that power to other disciplines. And this is like where a lot of real revolutionary shit happens, is when you start to be able to say like, I can control the flow of things through a centralized system to help advance not just one product, but all of my products that are consuming it at the same time.
Did you and your team try AvoCode and Cactus and all of the other design file Git managers that popped up? I assume they're all still around.
I haven't tried Cactus. I tried AvoCode. You know, honestly, the people that do it best are Abstract. I'm going to sound like a fanboy for a second.
Yeah, no. Abstract is the best UI. I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Abstract is pretty incredible at the way that it emulates Git and makes it accessible to designers, like to the point that you can actually like have, you know, multiple sketch files out there that are advancing in different directions and then merge them all back together. And the ability to do that is kind of black magic to me. Like, I've tried to tear apart a sketch file and to understand like what the JSON is that's behind it. And it's nuts. So
it's nuts.
Kudos to Abstract on that front.
I agree. So when I was at Deloitte, which is where I was before Google, I was a front end architect. I was like a product lead too, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, I was building products for people. And I was really pumped on this concept of version managing our design files. And here's the problem with this solution is designers don't want it. Right. And designers find the whole task of Abstract, even though Abstract is really nice looking, and honestly, it's about as good as I think a designer is ever going to get, at least for right now. I still couldn't convince a single designer to spend more than 20 stupid minutes in it. And all they did was get super frustrated. And even the design lead who was receiving these design offerings from designers didn't like the flow. And so this is hard, right? When it's like, well, the tech is better. Like, but why don't you do it? And you're like, well, I can't. Yeah. Anyway, so I had a people problem.
Exactly. And I was just, that's literally what I was about to say, is it sounds like you had a people problem. Like, you know, there's this idea of like what are the traditional role of a designer is, and you know, how you revision a file is like you change the file name. And, you know, that's not really revision control. And so you know, how you think about this concept in design land is it's about breaking down what traditionally being a designer means. I fundamentally believe, and you said this early on, that, you know, maybe I am one of those doomsayers holding the sign that like the old way is dying. But I fundamentally believe that the role of a designer is going to look really different 2 years from now, and 5 years from now, almost completely different. And a big part of the reason why is because design is going to be asked to work cross-functionally in a way that they haven't had to traditionally do. And I think the same goes for development. I really fundamentally believe it's the same paradigm on the opposite side of that mirror, where developers are going to be asked to do more and more and more design interpretation based on the rules that are laid out by designers. And this is where this power dynamic changes, right? Like the idea of like who's in control, right? You know, and maybe we're all just wrestling for control of the DOM at the end of the day, but design should be the people that make the rules and then work on those things that are very hard to interpret based on those rules. And then developers should be able to consume those rules and make decisions about the products that they're building based on them. I think that that is like the fundamental concept.
I agree. And I have this strong feeling that designers are the ones that should be making more choices. This is one of the reasons that I created VizBug, is I think developers are making decisions because no one answered them for them. Mm-hmm. And the due dates are there, and maybe they feel lightly equipped to do it. But then eventually you start to regret all those decisions, and then you start to get lazy and whatever, just shit piles up. And I want designers to be making more decisions. I want them instigating more, and developers to focus on the stuff that they like, which is system management, systems integration, speed, performance, rendering. They don't care about which hex value is coming out of the API, right? Mm-hmm. This is why token API systems are so awesome. But I also want, so I want to go back a little bit to the PR. Like, I want designers so much control that they submit the golden screenshot, that a developer yep. actually can't pass their PR unless the render matches the shit the designer provided. And then you have this control system where designers are the ones driving, where right now they are passengers. And I feel so bad for them. If you're on a product team right now, you're a passenger chasing it with stickers, chasing it with a design system, always behind, always uncanny, yep. no control, full victim. That sucks. That sucks so bad.
Yeah, it's a painful place to be. And that's like just a sad reality of so many product teams.
But if we get them into a scenario where, so VizBug lets you edit production. VizBug says, don't worry about a full constraint system. And I do want to come back to where design role is changing, because I agree. I think we're going deeper into interaction design and UX design. Like, those are roles that are fundamentally changing, and they're tool specific. But I also don't think we should ever get rid of the expressive flat canvas designer. Like,
oh, totally. I completely agree. Like, getting rid of somebody that design, right? Like, there's design, and then there's art direction, and there's all these like little sort of like sub disciplines, these little slices of what being a designer means. The broad canvas, mm-hmm. like, let me create something from nothing. Like, let me take an idea and give it form. Like, there is always a place for that. I just think that isn't giving form to the same damn button 500 different times.
Yeah, and that role sort of shows up and leaves at different intervals than like a interaction or UX designer role would. Where were we before that? It was a...
You're talking about VizBug and editing on production.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so VizBug. VizBug's whole thing is... VizBug was born out of... I've been trying all of these site editing design tools for so long. I have two of them sitting in my inbox right now that I need to go try building prototypes with. So this is design system focused, component oriented. I also really want to... Quick, spicy statement. Components aren't the answer. They're part of the answer. So anyway, I'm just going to leave that on the table. Everyone's like, components, we're done. I'm like, no, you're not. That barely answers a piece. Like, you, anyway.
No, you're totally right.
VizBug wants to skip. Okay. Anyway, VizBug wants to skip all of the tooling and all the schemas and all the integrations and all that shit. And it's just like, look, let the developers build their system on their platform and manage all the complexity. And designers, go use production as an artboard. Go get yourself logged into a QA user that has a bug logged at some ticket. Go solve the bug in production on the product.
Yep.
Like, there's no reason you have to screenshot it, go back into your make-believe world, go bring in your stickers. Like, everything you need is actually right there on the page in the real form of all the constraints of reality, which is the flow of the document, etc.
No, I mean, it's the medium it's destined
for. So I wanted to empower them there.
No, it's literally the medium it's destined for. It's this idea of, so where am I best able to make decisions about how things impact a customer or a consumer of my website? And that's in the actual website. That's not in a design tool. And I think that there is a place for design tools, right? Like, I don't think that anybody should like throw out every single sketch license. And like, I think that, you know, Figma is great and, you know, all this other stuff like that. I just think that mm-hmm. there's a purpose for them that we have far exceeded in our current environment.
Yeah, we've been pushing them for a long time. I love that design tools have opened up APIs into the values that designers are typing. That should have been a thing a long time ago.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about how you feel like VizBug is really enabling those designers to do a lot more of that prototyping kind of in the medium it's destined for. So, you know, you talk about editing production, like, you know, that is a big scary word and kind of a provocative statement of like, let my designers go edit production, right? So like, what do you actually mean when you talk about that?
Sure. So some of the things in practice are, you know, certain bugs will show up at a certain viewport. So I guess VizBug is not necessarily is not design system related at all. In fact, it's an ignorant design system a leverager. It can leverage the good choices you've made, but it won't change any of the source choices. Mm-hmm. And that means, like, if someone has written a good class that targets all the buttons, well, VisBug will let you click the class link, highlight all the buttons, and change the background of all the buttons in 5 seconds. You can test out a new color of buttons. So there's variant testing that you can do with it. I do a lot of chaos testing with it. So developers will be like, my component is done. And I'm like, cool, let me go click the link to your staging environment that's hosted. I'm going to launch VisBug. I'm going to double click on that user contributed comment. And I'm going to go like this. I'm just going to send it some crap. Because anytime you have user generated areas, expect some crap to show up in there, really short messages, ridiculously long messages. And so that's something I use VisBug for, is I'll QA something. And if I see a bug, I'll screenshot it. Maybe I'll resolve it because the margin was wrong. I'll go add some margin and be like, hey, in this one case, I added 5 pixels of margin here. Mm-hmm. One of the main things I like about this naivety and the leveraging of production is that all of the complexity of the reality of the application, which it's gonna be complex, it's inevitable, isn't on the weight of the designer. The designer gets to show up with just an eye,
yep,
and a desire, and VisBug is a method of expression. You go express your change, you send it to the developer, and the developer isn't trying to say, you know, oh, they gave me SAS. We're not writing SAS anymore. Or, oh, look, they gave me this. But it's just, and so there's, I almost always feel there's a translation moment. And I think even devs like translating because I think they like owning their domain. So it's like designers can show up naively and be like 15 pixels of margin on the right. And the developer's like, I know what they mean. It's a rem and a half. I'll just go, you know, stick a rem and a half in there and then ask them if they liked the change. And both people get to be professionals and owners of the domain. And VisBug is just this like expressive middle layer. But it has other uses too. It does accessibility inspecting. You can move things. So in terms of like Knapsack, you can visually grab and move things around on a page. It will change the DOM. So you can reorder. There's even a fun function called random. So let's say this is really fun for layout. You've chaos got a layout testing container. It's chaos testing, but it's also like variant testing. So I'll take a layout grid and I'll go randomly swap all the nodes and then I'll call it again. And I'll call it again. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at layouts that I never even thought of before. Mm-hmm. And I can be inspired by the computer's random nature. So it's like all of this stuff, like what do designers want to do to production, to play? And I want to try to enable it and give them some power in a place where they currently feel they have none. It's either open up the dev tools and tweak the Ferrari or take a picture of the Ferrari and go mess with it in Photoshop. And sorry, the Ferrari there is dev tools, everyone.
Maybe extended that analogy a little more. Anyway, I get your point. I think that you know, when you think about, you know, passengers in the car, if you will, right? Like the idea of I'm a designer, I want to go in and build this really incredible thing that I gave form to, right? If you're not actually the person building it, how do you know it turns out the way you want? One of the most common complaints we hear in our work is, you know, if I hand off a comp to 5 different developers, I will get 5 different results from that comp. Mm. And that's where a lot of this like breeding of inconsistency comes from. And that's where designers are like, yeah, heck yeah, design systems. That's going to fix that problem for me. Right. And it very well may, but the cautionary tale there is like, you know, that is based on the notion that design is willing to take the time to formulate all those rules. And I think that like where a tool like VisBug really plays into that is you basically can see where you have gaps in your rule book, right? Like if you're writing the book of laws for how you interpret your digital experiences, like, you know, where does that book need some editing? Yeah. And the ability to kind of understand where maybe things aren't performing the way you want through chaos and entropy or, you know, rigorous VRT testing. You know, one way or another, you kind of get to this idea of like, how comprehensive is my system of rules that defines the interpretation of those designs?
I want to dig into that too, because for me, that was something I saw that was still massively unanswered by design systems is composition. You know, this is also where atoms, molecules, and pages, or wherever the next biggest organic thing you want to label starts to happen, is molecules make sense-ish, because you might have 5 different types of a molecule. And so it might be a molecule of 5 states, but then how does one of those substates interact with another molecule when it's next to it? And do you have to make an organism to encapsulate the logic of two molecules side by side? And all of a sudden, your Lego concept becomes really a difficult graph of complexity, because you don't, do we expect designers to say what happens in every one of those states? Or how do we build some intelligence in there so that composition isn't so explicit? So yeah, we have this thing where we've got these portable Legos. Maybe they're portable. I usually feel like they're, you asked for a banana, but you got a gorilla holding a banana. So anyway, I feel like components always come with this baggage. You're like, I thought you were portable. Anyway, but it's like, okay, I took two components, I put them next to each other. I'm like, this design system isn't smart at all. That's a moronic way to put those next to each other. There's an obvious relationship here I'm going for. Why isn't that built in the system? And so I see, you know, in Basalt, and I see in a lot of systems, we have schemas that show slots and like allowed slots. We have like a slotting mechanism, but we don't have a sibling mechanism, for example. And we put everything on parent and child. And maybe that's good for most of the time. Like, it's really good for spacing, but it's terrible for like intelligence. It's kind of why we want container queries. Anyway, I'm ranting a little bit, but we need integration layers between components somehow defined in our system in order to the intelligence to scale. I don't know.
No, I think that it's a valid point. I think that there's direction there, right? That is, there's people talking about this. Is slots enough, right? And slots is a very generalized term. And so there's lots of people that are thinking about slots as subcomponents, or slots as peer components, or maybe even slots as parent components. And so how you interpret those things is perhaps overly broad right now, right? Like where we need maybe a little bit more specific direction in the languages and methods we use to implement these sorts of things. Because, you know, like to take something like very simple, right? Like a three-up card layout, like, you know, every single product feature page ever created, right? Big hero image, yep. Three-up card, you know, contact us button. And so, you know, when you think about that, like, you know, what determines like what goes in that three-up card? Well, that's a grid with cards, and those cards maybe have buttons inside of them. You know, there's a hierarchy to the way the page is constructed that sort of mirrors the hierarchy of the design system. And I think that that's like kind of what Brad was always kind of alluding to with Adam's molecules, organisms, pages, templates, is that like little things make bigger things, which make bigger things, which make pages.
Yeah.
And I think that like, you know, there's also a lot of interpretations of the atomic model, right? Like you can ask somebody, hey, is a button an atom?
I saw that in Basalt, actually. You guys have buttons as atoms. And in my head, I'm like, ooh, that's a molecule to me.
Right, right. Exactly. And that's a big point of contention for lots of people, right? Because, you know, are atoms just colors and grids and spacing and typography, or are they actual like usable things? And I think that, you know,
yeah,
you could also, again, take kind of the GitLab approach and basically say like, okay, well, what is a button? But typography, a grid, a spacing, and a color fill.
It's got icons and yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, basically their idea is that like a button can be still broken down into the component parts of design tokens. But I mean, to answer your fundamental question there of like, you know, how do we construct these more complex relationships between components? The answer is that's a very manual process right now.
Yeah.
And trying to understand like, you know, in your three up product page, like what the relationship is of one card to another, you know, is that a sibling or is that just an ordinal? Is that a button inside of a card the same level as the call to action button that's below it? Like, how do you actually like construct some of the interesting relationships between component context? And I don't really feel like that's a solved problem yet. I think that that's kind of like the next step, much like how content and localization is another like next step for these things, right? You were talking earlier about your podcast and talking about some of the localization pieces. You know, this is a really hard problem, right? It's like, okay, so there is a role that content has to play inside of design systems. That's through defining edit forms. That's through helping define schemas. That's through helping define like what are the potential variant pieces of content that can go into this. And also, mm-hmm. I think that there's a broader role for content to play of like what do my assets look like? What do my like common text snippets look like? Like, do I have a tagline? Is like tagline a component now? And we haven't solved those problems like at all. But if the moment you start to think about a lot of these broader content things, you can't help but think about like localization, internationalization, experience personalization, all these much more complex concepts that I think are a lot more on the bleeding edge of where we're headed with design systems.
Yeah, I've seen some cool tools that sort of help. It's almost like in our design systems, we're currently solving the happy path, which is a typical design task as well, right? They give you an optimal comp, right? Oh, this user has really nice pictures that they uploaded. Their avatars. Right, right. Great.
It doesn't matter. They're 14 megabytes for one picture. But
well, it's also like, hey, you go log into the real site and most people don't have an avatar and they, you know, their page looks abandoned and you didn't have a whole lot of empty state handling. And so it just sort of looks like no calls to action. And so there's tools. Yeah, there's tools that will basically project into, you know, 100 different variants or something and try to expose the edges where you're wrong. And I think those are really interesting. Like, I don't know if you've seen a lot of the AI driven designs tools that are coming out. They're very design system oriented, AI driven. And essentially, which I agree with, is that a designer is better at saying what they don't like than what they do like. So you let the computer mm-hmm. generate a bunch of stuff and it doesn't know any better, but it can learn over time, right? Machine learning. It'll get better. Just
Hand wave,
ML, hand wave, Python. But I've seen them work reasonably well. We're like, sure, here's 50 layouts. You're like, 49 of those are just dumb. Like, that's dumb. Hey, that one's not so bad, right? And so you can kind of like train it and to get it somewhere through telling it what you don't like, which is kind of a fun opposite mentality to design systems, which are all about telling it what is acceptable. And I guess what I want to bring this back into this concept of constraints, which is what I don't think a lot of design systems are good at articulating. And it's sort of like this relationship, mm-hmm. right? But it's more of a constraint system. And I think that's the exciting part of design systems is our ability to continually tighten the constraints of our beliefs. It's like all of these things that we've known subliminally and we keep in our heads as a design and development team that are building products is the constraints. And if we can codify those and abstract them and deliver them in a way that you empower people, a little bit like how TypeScript is pitched.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more constrained, but it has some really nice garden paths if you're willing. If you walk down,
yeah, right? and we make extensive use of TypeScript for exactly that reason. You know, like the ability to basically say, like, hey, I can go and define my rules. I can express my constraints in some meaningful way, even as a non-technical user, and then have that show up as inline immediate
guidance.
Documentation guidance when you're actually going and implementing that thing. Like, that's a really powerful concept too. Like, that's how you get a more consistent expression of a design concept actually in code, is when you allow like your designers to define your TypeScript variables for you.
Yeah.
Even if they don't know that they're doing it.
Well, that's why YAML is so good, right? You just translate that YAML to some typed objects and pass those through your system.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, you know, there is a lot of power here. And I think the takeaway from this conversation is like, there are so many places where this can go and so many impacts that this has on the way we think about building software that, mm-hmm. you know, not all of the kinks have been worked out yet. And I think it's largely because like, we're still new in this, right? I mean, the first time I ever heard what a design system was about 4 years ago. Like, that's nothing in terms of like the scope of technology. And yet it's also, a lot has changed in 4 years.
Yeah.
And so as things continue to evolve, I think that we're going to start to solve this problem of fragmentation, this problem of version control for designers, this problem of how you express constraints, this problem of content, this problem of native applications, that are all these gap areas that we haven't totally figured out yet. But I think that there's a lot of really smart people working on them.
Yeah. And I'd love to see, in addition to designers and developers and empowering designers, ultimately, I think they're the ones that want to make the right. And what I mean by right is user-driven decisions. Devs are going to mm-hmm. generally lean towards a dev decision. Is I also want to see your QA, your PMs, and your other people in this tool contributing, because that's another thing that's often lost when things are too tight between dev and design, is you have technical, intelligent, you know, savvy folks using the product, and then you have someone show up who's naive and they point out something that's just so obvious. And it needs to be empowering for them. They need to be able to show up to a PR and be able to express a flaw mm-hmm. as simply as an advanced engineer could. So yeah, we have a lot of things to solve with design systems. It's not hopeless, but I guess here, I want to throw out one more topic as we, I don't know if we're going to wrap up or what, but...
No, you're good.
Okay. Is this, and this is just a thing I'm personally torn with. I have no answers here. There's a slider. On one end is the most abstract, normalized... So normalization is like a database term, right? Every table has been reduced to its most small, finite thing. And then we have abstraction, where it's like you've abstracted yourself into complete dryness. It's not a single moment of repetition. Everything is either leveraging polymorphism or whatever, right? You just got this system perfectly.
Mega modularity, right?
Mega modularity, right? And then on the opposite side of this, you have a hand-rolled single file application, right? Okay, so... Going all the way to the abstract extreme end is shit. And I hate that world. It is worse. And while it has some powers, and I like understanding the trade-offs and powers that I gained there, as soon as I get too close to over there, I start to pull back. And I feel like design systems, I keep doing that, where I chase this dryness. I chase this desire to be efficient and to be good. But then I reach a point where I'm actually hurting myself. Like TypeScript does this to me all the time. You know, I'm like, man, I spent all this time. Yeah. You're laughing. Here, yeah, go ahead.
I love the idea of like TypeScript poking you with a sharp stick every once in a while.
Well, TypeScript, I want to rely on TypeScript to be smarter than me, right? And I put that in quotes. But there's so many times where TypeScript's like, this doesn't work. And I'm like, oh man, I'm going to have to spend the next hour teaching you that it does work. Right? I'm smarter than you, TypeScript, damn it. And you give me an opportunity to teach you. And that usually means I have to go abstract more. And what's weird is like, in order to solve an abstraction problem, I have to go deeper into abstraction. And I find design systems being sucked into this same vortex, this abstraction vortex. We're in token land. Oh shit, man. Our tokens are hosted on a GraphQL server and I can pull them down in JSON. Mm-hmm. That is an amazing abstraction. Anyway, so it's like it comes with like some new hindrances, right? Now I can't just get my colors. I can't just go edit my color. I have to go into the CMS, into the graph database, find it, make an entry, la 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 la. So it's like in this world of this slider, where do you find yourself in these polars? And this isn't a realistic question to ask anybody, but I guess I just want to know your general sentiment about like, where are you at there?
No, that's funny that you say that it's not a realistic question. I ask that question of our customers constantly.
You do?
Yeah. it wouldn't be one of these podcasts if we didn't bring up the book that Alla Komotova wrote, Design Systems, the Smashing Mag book. She talks about the continuum of modular and integrated. And that's kind of how like she frames it. And so, you know, when I frame that to a customer, I talk about it as a cultural problem, right? Like this is a cultural thing you need to address inside of your organization. And this represents how far we go with your design system, right? If you are very, very hard on the modular side of things, you could get 80, 90, 95% of your experiences powered by your design system. But that will be a fairly rigid set of controls. If you're like really favoring the integrated side of things, like you're probably going to get to like 50% of your experiences are powered by your design system. Me personally, I come from an engineering background. And so like, you know, heck yeah, modularity.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, I tend to find myself personally on that side of things. I'm always constantly reminding myself that not everybody is there. Right. There's lots of people that just, you know, they don't ever want to start with an atom and a molecule. They want to start with organisms, and they want those each to be their own distinct things that are, you know, maybe reusable a dozens times instead of 10,000 times. And that's totally fine. Like that's still advancing things in the right direction, even if it's not necessarily as far as I would personally take it.
Yep. That was a very good answer. I'm very pleased by it. And it reminds me of there's just so many design system topics, but I just wanted to give people some inspiration about how there are people in your design system too. Like they're so easily forgotten in a world of mm-hmm. automation and an abstraction. I guess my I just want to implore listeners that there are people behind all of this, and it takes a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of alignment and a lot of advocacy, a lot of sales. So design systems don't get used by themselves. They must be sold. They must be pitched and presented and made easy. And all of their powers, I think, can be delivered. But the cost isn't very honest most of the time. Like people, I don't think, are very honest about the cost of design systems. And so what I like about you and your company is that you are honest about it. You're admitting that it is very difficult, and we will solve it for you because that's what we do. We are prepared mm-hmm. for this difficulty. We're armed and ready and equipped and experienced. I like that. So anyway, just everyone out there, design systems are built with people. As much and as cool as the tech could ever get, the tech could sit there and get dusty without folks. So I don't know. That's the other side of this abstraction thing too. It's just like, I don't know, we could abstract ourselves into the abyss, but without users and consumers, it's all for naught.
No, and you're completely right. And we talk about this a lot too, right? It's like when you're sitting there and you have this continuum in front of you and you're like, yeah, I want to be like fully on that modular side. The thing that we also say is that like the more modular you get, the more it breaks the human processes that you have.
That's a struggle. It's frustrating.
Most people are coming from a more integrated sort of solution set, right? Like where they're building like things screen at a time, or they have maybe some sense of components, or they've started with component library. Mm-hmm. But if they're trying to really truly move into like more abstract modular land, it breaks down the day-to-day work that people do. And that often is like really hard for an organization. And so when you say, I'm going to have a really highly modular system that has the, you know, a handful of components that do 10,000 things each, that breaks people's brains. And it really like kind of shatters the reality of what their day-to-day job is. Mm-hmm. And that can be really taxing, not just on the organization, but about the people that are part of the organization. And I've actually seen, you know, people leave companies because they felt like the design system changed too much about the way their life was at that organization.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is important to keep in mind that you know, man, the tech is so not 100% of the thing.
Yeah.
Much like components don't make a design system, good design systems tools don't make a successful design systems implementation.
Yep. I mean, you could have the best tools, the best tech, the best everything, and a shitty group of folks. It'd be miserable. And then you could have, I like this Lego analogy. You pour out a bunch of Legos on a table. The Legos aren't the value. The Legos are the team that assembled them. Mm-hmm. Now you have one team that can take those Legos and make a Harry Potter castle. Right? They took garbage components, single turds that don't mean anything on their own, and they built something amazing. You could give the same set to somebody else and not get something good. You could give a different set that has like the castle roof already built, or it has these like specialty pieces, and you still might not get a cool castle like the first team. So sometimes we over attribute good design and good success and good UI and good experience to tooling and process, when I think we need to give more kudos to the people. Anyway, that was just my little finale.
Well said. Hey, man, that was super great.
Yeah,
that was
a blast.
So much fun. This pod has been brought to you by Knapsack. You can check us out at knapsack.cloud or at knapsackcloud on Twitter. Thanks so much, Adam, for being a part of things today. Really appreciate you, man. Looking forward to continuing this conversation over beers sometime in the future.
Feelings are likewise. Yep. Or they're mutual.
All right, man. Have a good one. That's all for today. We'd love to hear from you with questions, ideas for new episodes, beer recommendations, or comments. You can find us on Twitter at @thedspod. Cheers, and thanks for listening to the Design Systems Podcast.